I want to go home. I'm tired.
I'm going to call the House Committee on Health Care to order for this lovely first day of July. Was probably the last meeting of this session. And I'm going to open an informational meeting with two topics. One, the finalization of the exchange transfer to the Department of Consumer and Business Services, and the other topic, also DCBS, an update on the health insurance rate review for 2016. And I welcome you all to be with us today. Thank you for agreeing to do this. Pat, will you start?
Absolutely. Thank you, Chair Greenlick, members of the committee and Senate guests. My name is Patrick Allen. I'm the Director of the Department of Consumer and Business Services. I'm joined today by Insurance Commissioner Laura Calley and by Barry Leslie, who is the Administrator of the Health Insurance Marketplace within DCBS. We're happy to be here to, as you say, provide you an update on the marketplace as well as give you some information on rate review. Today is July 1st, and so as of today, Cover Oregon no longer exists as an independent organization. That process went really without without a lot of wrinkles or difficulty or challenges. There was a lot of work involved in getting that to happen. And just a couple of things about the people involved in that work. I again want to comment on the extreme professionalism and dedication to the staff who were at Cover Oregon through the end under very difficult circumstances for them, in circumstances largely not of their own making. They did an outstanding job of working with us to assure that that the work that they were in the midst of was handed off to us smoothly and competently. And then to our own staff who have now been hired to run this function, who did a great job getting up to speed very quickly and hitting the ground running and being able to move that forward. There were a lot of people involved in making sure that this was uneventful, which I think was the goal we were all looking for. A few significant pieces of work. You'll remember potentially during the early part of the session when we were talking about Senate Bill 1, there was a notion of 2014 work that needed to be closed out as a significant piece of this. And there were some particular pieces that I know were generating some constituent calls for you. Agent commissions was the most significant of that. There was when we started this process back in March, there was a significant block of probably $2 million in unpaid commissions for 2014 work that was outstanding. That largely attached to a couple of carriers who there was a complex reconciliation process that we were getting bogged down in. We were able to successfully complete that work, and those carrier commissions have now almost 100% been taken care of. There are still potentially some questions at the margins, but we think that that work is now done. My sense is that you have stopped getting phone calls about unpaid commissions in the way that you were early in the session. The 1095 tax reporting work is all complete. All of those materials have been reported to the IRS. All of the statements have been provided to taxpayers, and so there's not an overhang of that work, which was a second area that we were concerned about. And then the third was the advanced premium tax credit error that Cover Oregon had created while they were doing calculations in 2014. And you may recall it was an issue of the system that they were using to do these calculations made an incorrect assumption about a plan value that caused people to have that the tax credit that they were given was frequently higher than it should have been, which meant their premium was lower than it should have been. Good news while you were paying the premium, bad news when you went to reconcile your taxes. Cover Oregon had set aside a significant amount of money to pay claims related to damages as a result of that. We established an expedited claims process, and the news is that we think we have worked through the body of that work, and it was quite a bit smaller than we had feared. But that process is now complete, and so all of those issues now really are sort of in the rearview mirror. There are not big overhanging unknown questions on the horizon that stem from those three pieces of work. Cover Oregon offices have now been closed. We actually closed them as of last Friday. One other piece to mention. if you follow online comments or those kinds of things, there's certainly a notion out there of, well, you know, we just found them all other jobs somewhere else in state government or absorbed them into DCBS or whatever else. I will tell you that of the 150 or so people who worked at Cover Oregon 9 months or a year ago, we moved about 15 directly into positions at DCBS. We, as part of the hiring of the other 15 staff for a total staffing of about 30 at DCBS, there were a small handful that competed for those positions in open competitive processes and got them. But in the main, those folks were laid off in different increments of time, but there were about 25 people in the final round who were laid off as of yesterday. So there was not some sort of a part and parcel wholesale conversion of those folks to state government. A couple of other things to comment on. As we work through this process, we're working closely in coordination with Department of Justice, with CMS, the Centers for Medicaid and Medicare Services in the federal government, and with the health authority. You'll recall that once upon a time, the notion was Cover Oregon as a single entity to do the work of multiple agencies. By eliminating Cover Oregon, we've really sort of disentangled that. That means there's an extra onus on us as agencies to work together very closely to make sure we don't have sort of silo problems where this work has now been separated, and we're establishing the processes to make sure that that's the case. Also, just thinking about the organization as it's structured, as I said, there are about 30 staff in the marketplace section of DCBS going forward. That compares, as I said, to about 150 staff at Cover Oregon a year ago. Now, in total fairness, the nature of the work in the organizations is vastly different. A year ago and 2 years ago, certainly, Cover Oregon was largely a technology acquisition organization that was also operating a program, and that element of our work is now gone, and we are 100% a program organization. So that really changes the nature of the work. So in terms of current status, we now have an outreach center up and running at the Department of Consumer and Business Services. Those are the folks who are able to take calls from people who are having challenges, difficulties, have questions. That work ramps up significantly during open enrollment as people work on being able to purchase their policies. All of the positions now for the marketplace are filled. They were largely filled as of mid to late May so that we had some overlap of staff so that we could do a knowledge transfer of the things that we needed to know to be able to do that work. We're working on a discussion in Ways and Means around the budget for the marketplace arose around outreach and marketing dollars, and in particular a concern to make sure that we had metrics in place to be able to assess the effectiveness of that work, and so we're beginning the process of developing those metrics so that we can come back in February during the short session and report to the body on how we'll know whether we're getting our money's worth and getting effective outreach and marketing for those dollars. Senate Bill 1 creates an advisory committee that we anticipate beginning a recruitment process for just shortly after session ends, which means that we're aiming toward being able to come back in September from a confirmation standpoint. Those advisory committee positions are appointed by the governor, confirmed by the Senate. In the meantime, we've established an informal kitchen cabinet of similar sorts of folks representing similar kinds of constituencies to make sure that we're not spending the first 6 months of this effort kind of operating in a vacuum without being closely connected to stakeholders in the effort. That group has met a couple of times now and is providing us valuable input on everything from outreach work to the request for proposal we're about ready to work on releasing for the SHOP function, and I'll come back to that in a minute. Actually, I'll come back to it right now as I look over at my outline. SHOP, you'll recall, is the small business marketplace that we're required to establish under state and federal law. After Senate Bill 1 passed, we did a request for information around what was available in the marketplace. The biggest challenge with SHOP, as it has played out across the states, is that the size of the market for those small business policies appears to be quite a bit smaller than was originally envisioned by the creators of the overall system and plan. And so we're dealing with what's the best way to approach being able to provide a platform for people to use to access SHOP at a cost that doesn't have some kind of a big incremental buy-in or some kind of a development cost or something like that. We completed that RFI process. We believe that we've got access to a vendor marketplace that will allow us to either use a vendor system or use the federal system, depending on some policy changes we can make. And that process is moving forward. We anticipate being able to roll out shop accessibility sometime in late 2016, early 2017, which will be largely consistent with what the federal requirements are for that. The other big piece of an unknown that we're dealing with right now, you may recall that right now Oregon uses the federal platform as the website that people go to purchase plans. That was free to us for the open enrollment period for 2015 and will be free to us again for 2016. We don't expect that it will be free going forward, but we don't actually have a firm cost for that. Our position is that whether it's because of cost or functionality or, as of before the decision last week, not knowing what the tax credit status might be, we need to be in a position where we actually have a meaningful choice of platforms and are able to, if necessary, move from the federal platform to the Kentucky platform that we have already put in place, that we're in the middle of putting in place now for Medicaid systems, some other state platform, some other vendor solution, just about any choice out there other than hiring an IT contractor to come and write a bunch of code for us and build a system. Our expectation is to be in a position by about February to know what direction we're going to go, because if you kind of do the timeline, that's about the timeline we would need to be able to make some sort of a change from the federal system, while at the same time negotiating with the federal government on what the cost of their system might be going forward. In a perfect world, we would be able to stay on the federal system because that involves the least amount of dislocation for Oregonians in terms of how they access their insurance. A couple of other things, and then I'll see if there are questions that you might have. We want to continue to improve our understanding of what is ultimately the actual marketplace for private insurance. We had about 112,000 enrollments during open enrollment for 2015. And our uninsured rate in Oregon today, depending on which report you look at, is somewhere in the on the order of 5 to 8% of Oregonians. Well, who are those 5 to 8% of Oregonians who are uninsured? Are they potential customers of the marketplace? Are they unreached Medicaid customers? Are they something different? And what are the most effective ways to get them covered so that they've got access to health care? We need to really understand that to be able to be as effective as we can with the system. And the last thing I want to touch on is just the notion of insurance literacy and our potential role as a marketplace in helping people make good purchasing decisions. We are blessed with one of, if not the most competitive individual health insurance market in the country, with 13 individual policy providers, I think 15 providers in the small group market, and that provides lots and lots and lots and lots of choice for consumers. Each of those carriers have a large number of individual plans that have features that vary in terms of co-pays and co-insurance and deductibles and out-of-pocket limits, as well as premium. And if you drill down into cases that you can hear about now where people are dissatisfied with the insurance they got, seems that what's frequently happening is someone is buying a policy based on premium, getting the cheapest premium they can, which is understandable, but not understanding that that cheaper premium maybe was not as good a value a plan for them based on their health care needs compared to a plan that had a higher premium but lower deductibles or treated medications that they take differently or those sorts of things. And so we're working on how to provide better, more robust tools for Oregonians to use to be able to more easily make those kinds of choices. The last thing I'll say, and then I'll see if there are questions you have, is that we really view our mission in the next couple of years is to build credibility with you in particular. We want to demonstrate that we can deliver this program, that we can do it without there being a lot of news about it, that we can tell you what we're going to do and do what we tell you, and that that this system operates in the way that you have intended and handed it off to us, and that really is our touchstone in terms of being able to provide value to Oregonians. With that, before we turn to rates, I'd be happy to answer any questions you might have.
Does the new director have any comments to make?
Hello. Hello. My name again for the record is Barry Leslie. I'm the administrator of the Oregon Health Insurance Marketplace, which is part of the Department of Consumer and Business Services. I think my only comments would just be to echo what Pat said, and that is just a huge thanks to the employees at Cover Oregon and to the employees who've taken over the marketplace. They just did a wonderful job really focusing on our number one priority, which is providing service to Oregonians and being there as a resource. And so it was a great opportunity to come together, and we're really excited about delivering a successful open enrollment period for Oregonians. Thank you.
All right. Let's open it for questions or comments. Representative Lively.
Thank you, Chair Greenlee. So I'd like to hear a little bit more about your the program, what you're going to do to understand better the uninsured population, to identify them, because I appreciate if you're going to target them, you have to understand. So how are you going to reach out and find out what makes up that 5 to 8%? Uninsured.
Sure, Chair Greenlee, Representative Lively. Let me comment quickly, and then I'll turn it to Barry. A combination of work with our advisory committee, which is designed to have a broad stakeholder representation, work with the outreach functions that exist today at OHA that we want to be able to partner with so that we take advantage of investments they've already made in understanding those populations, as well as our own outreach center are the kind of the locuses of that work. Barry, you want to talk in a little bit more detail about that?
Sure. Again, this is Barry Leslie. I'm the administrator for the Oregon Health Insurance Marketplace. Thank you for your question. We're going to approach it in several ways. And the first thing that we're doing, as you suggest, it's important to understand where these people are and who they are. And so we're working with a number of different organizations that provide data about Oregon, about where the uninsured population is, and then kind of what does the population look like in terms of demographics and just all kind of any kind of details we can get about those organizations, and then try to figure out, okay, once we know where they are and kind of what these folks look like in terms of income and how they can best be communicated with, it's targeting our outreach campaign to actually reach them in a way that's effective for that population. So part of that is working with organizations like the Oregon Health Authority to understand how they reach different communities in Oregon. And then the other part of that is also working really closely with the agent community. They've done a great job over the years really being there for Oregonians, both in the Medicaid program and in the QHP program, and so we're developing a really significant partnership with them to help us reach out to Oregonians. So it's understanding the population and then doing a really intentional outreach strategy to reach those folks.
Thank you.
Senator Miles Anderson?
Well, believe it or not, that was pretty much my question. I know that there it isn't your role to look at undocumented, of course, but in my district we have homeless and a lot of young people living with other families. And so we do, at least in my district, still have a lot of uninsured. But you answered my question as to what you'll be doing to find out who those people are and where they are.
Yes, sir.
Chair Greenlee, thank you. Thank you for the presentation. Just taking a couple of the bullet points here. One of them says that you're building credibility with us. Another one says that there was no disruption to customers when you closed the Cover Oregon office. My understanding was that Cover Oregon never signed any customers up. Is that correct?
Chair Greenlee, Representative Hayden, no, that's not correct. Cover Oregon put in place a manual process to back up the Oracle process. So it's accurate to say that Oracle didn't provide a website that allowed Cover Oregon to sign any customers up, but that manual process signed up several hundred thousand people through the Medicaid system and about 70,000 people for qualified health plans through the marketplace.
So all of those customers, none of which were on the Cover Oregon electronic system, all the manual customers that got signed up are now in the state exchange as of July 1st?
Chair Greenlee, Representative Hayden, that's correct. First, just to be clear, because this is
You drop back just a little bit and follow them.
Yeah. The piece that did not work was the customer-facing website from Oracle. There was a back-office piece that Oracle delivered that works well enough to have been used by CoverOrg in operating the manual process to be able to basically take those paper applications and input information and put it into that back office system. So they exist in a computerized system to manage that process. Those were about 70,000 people, plus or minus. That's an off the top number. Those customers then for 2014. For 2015, customers needed to go separately to the healthcare.gov federal marketplace and basically re-sign up to purchase their policies. So they exist in both places now because that 2014 year's worth of work still exists. In fact, people were able to sign up for policies up until March 31st of this year for 2014 policies, a family change, those kinds of circumstances. They exist in the federal system for 2015 if they had coverage in both years. That system will remain unchanged now for 2016 because we'll again be on the federal system. Does that help?
It helps.
116,000.
Okay. For 2015, that's right.
So many of the employees that you talked about laying off are those data entry employees. Is that correct?
Chair Greenlich, Representative Hayden, no, the data entry, the peak employment at CoverOrg was about 300 employees, and that was really, that included the wave of temporary employees necessary to do the back office work. This was largely a large wave of call center employees who were working with people on that 2014 body of work, and then a variety of other functions in the organization that tailed off as we neared closure of the organization.
One more follow-up?
Sure.
Or have I taken
no,
too
no
much
we've
time?
Got time.
Okay. Okay, and then one more of your bullet points. You said ongoing communication with CMS. Would you talk about any, and I'm not sure how involved you are with this, but any ongoing review or liability coming out of that communication with CMS from past going into the future and what liabilities Oregon may still have?
Yeah, Chair Greenlich, Representative Hayden, I'm going to use we kind of variably here because with the passage of Senate Bill 1, I became for about 4 months the CEO of CoverOrg until it ended. So bear with me in terms of that. But we, CoverOrg, had a site visit from CMS, which was effectively an audit that took the better part of a week about 2 months ago. Mm-hmm. We have not yet seen their findings from that site visit, and so there could be something that would come of that. Of course, there are some congressional investigations ongoing and those sorts of things. Nothing out of that process has, to this point, articulated a definable liability that I could point to and say so-and-so organization has found us liable for a thing or a dollar amount or anything like that. That's not to say that that couldn't happen yet where we are in the process, but nothing has been defined to this point.
Just one more, and then I'll be done.
Would
you mind, thank you, would you mind describing some of the things when you said that they came in and did a review? What were they asking for? What were they looking at?
I'll ask Ms. Leslie to help me on this, but basically it was a programmatic audit that was reviewing our accounting procedures, contracting processes, all of the various elements of business management, our outreach and marketing. Really, it was a comprehensive grant management audit that looked at all facets of the organization and asked questions and engaged in testing to assure that we were complying with the terms of the federal grant. Did I miss anything significant?
Not really, no.
Thank you.
I've got a couple of questions.
Go first?
Go ahead.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just quick question. Sorry for getting here late, but I stuck in caucus too long and probably should have been here rather than there. But
I had that feeling when I left.
I guess kind of where I'm at on some of this, because there's a lot of good software companies out there, and I've seen a lot of them, SAP, Oracle, different ones that are out there. And we put a lot of
good ones.
So, well, they're headaches, but SAP and Oracle both do a very good job in the industrial world, where I'm at in the accounting side and everything. And that's where I'm just kind of curious. We had a huge investment with Oracle. is there any of that that's salvageable that can be used in the process? Or, and the other question would be, what does DAS use? Are you using SAP? Because that's one of the big problems I have with the state is you have every little department using its own software rather than having one program that everybody uses. Because when we try to get numbers and find out what's happening with somebody, it's a pain. And it's, we almost feel like you're hiding things from us at times because we can't get the information. And I have people from different departments coming in and complaining because DAS charges them so much to do the work when they're one- or two-person show that they just go by their own little off-the-shelf program for it. So with what's there from Oracle, I guess the first question would be, what is DAS using currently for a system? Is there anything salvageable from Oracle, or is there no compatibility there?
Yeah, so,
let me add to that question as well, because it was my first question. I mean, the answer is what are you guys using for information technology stuff? But we talked about the failure of processes. We're cleaning up both the tax issue and other issues and cleaning up. I was wondering how confident you are now of the processes that you put in place to replace whatever it was that we were worried about in the past, and that's sort of a part of that same question.
Sure, Greenlick, Representative Widener, there's a lot wrapped up in those sets of questions. Let me give it a shot, and you will catch me if I forget any pieces. First, in terms of the Oracle system, as I mentioned earlier, Oracle did not deliver a functioning website front end. They did deliver a marginally functional back end, and that system was used by Cover Oregon to deal with the 2014 enrollments and the work that continued from that. And the health authority uses that back end today to manage the Medicaid population until it converts over to the Kentucky system early next year. So there is a piece of Oracle software there's an Oracle system in place that's got some marginal functionality and is being used. That Oracle backend is carried on the Cover Oregon financial statement at a residual value that is north of $60 million. I would need to get you a specific dollar amount that comes from the audited financial statement for Cover Oregon in terms of its value. Now, that's an accounting dollar amount assigned to it, which is somewhat different than a practical value in terms of its functionality. Any comment beyond that I could make? If I know about it, I can't talk about it, and if I can talk about it, I don't really know about it. So I think that's really all the further I can go about the Oracle system as it exists today because of the litigation that's ongoing. You ask about what system does DAS have. Well, given that we have moved to the federal platform, there is no system in Oregon for 2015 and 2016 that's performing this work. We're using the federal technology platform to do all of that work, and so there's not a piece of something that has been purchased by the state to manage this body of work. Now, this lives within Department of Consumer and Business Services, and so we use all of the ordinary state systems to conduct our business as an agency, and that includes being able to manage work related to the health insurance marketplace, but that's different than the Oracle platform. To Representative Greenlick's question about our confidence level going forward, I would certainly not want to represent that we are certain everything is put to bed and taken care of. We're reasonably confident that there are not significant surprises to turn up in that area. And I say that with some degree of confidence because we have passed now several places where there are activities like tax filing or agent reconciliation statements that have been sent out that if there were pervasive problems with the data or with the systems, that would have generated some kind of a response. And we didn't see that sort of a response that would give us suspicion that there was a larger problem. Now, back to Representative Widener's comment about state systems generally. Wearing yet a third hat, I'm a member of the state's enterprise leadership team, and I chair the Improving Government Steering Team, which is a subset of agency directors and business service directors who work on how to make state government operate more effectively and efficiently. And this IT issue that you're talking about is absolutely a critical issue, and there's legislation that's in the body right now related to the role of the state CIO. We've been in negotiations, for example, about taking one of those systems, the state HR system, the position database, and these old systems that are written in COBOL, and we're having a hard time finding living COBOL programmers to maintain them, and working on working with you to get the authorization to be able to move forward to modernize those systems and put them into more vendor standard kinds of projects and those kinds of things. So we're working on trying to deal with those issues, but you know, the hit to our credibility, frankly, of CoverOregon has been a huge barrier to being able to work on resolving those kinds of problems. And that's why I talk about there are a couple of bullets in there that talk about building credibility, because we have to demonstrate that we can do this work. We know for you to be able to have the confidence to be willing to let us tackle trying to improve these other systems. That was a really long-winded answer, but it was a multi-part question. So,
Mr.
Chair, you have another question?
Okay.
So, because, I mean, I'm fortunate. I'm probably one of the few members that has had an opportunity to work with a lot of these different companies out in the field. And the biggest failure I see to a lot of systems, because I do the same thing, it's just leadership in it and knowing what needs to happen, knowing how to set up that hierarchy structure and how it breaks down through the channels and what it needs to do. And that's one of the things we saw that happened with CoverOregon. I mean, I have talked with whistleblowers, I've talked with lots of different people, had them in my office, met them off-site and everything, and there was a lack of leadership, basically, and someone to say, no, this is what we're going to do. And I'm just wondering, do you feel that we have that now? Is there somebody that's going to be the lead that actually knows how a system should be set up and is going to say, okay, this is what's going to do, and not get running off, oh, yeah, let's do this, oh, yeah, let's do this, oh, do this over here?
Well, that's why we hired a CIO to do exactly that. That's what Mr. Pettit's job is, and my impression is he's doing it fairly well.
I just wanted on the record for them to say that, yes, we feel confident and we have the leadership to make this happen.
Yeah, and if we're talking about at the enterprise level in terms of technology issues broadly, absolutely, and Chair Greenlick is exactly right in terms of the role of the state CIO. If we're talking about the health insurance marketplace specifically, we have no plans to do a technology project for which that kind of an identified role is required. Now, I'm accountable for the successful delivery of this set of programs. And that includes our role with the federal government to use their technology, and includes whatever we're going to do from a shop standpoint. I can tell you that first, I have no plans for us to go off and hire a developer to write code and develop us a system. Secondly, that's going to mean using existing platforms, existing technology, existing stuff that actually works. and the focus really is on making sure that we do what we need to do to make sure Oregonians have access to health insurance policies and keep that as simple and straightforward as we possibly can.
Yeah, and I must say, I've, in my relatively long business career, working with a $10 billion organization and consulting with other organizations, I watched IBM screw up a major development of a system. I watched Intel in their internal enterprise have real problems trying to get something off the ground. And I certainly watched Kaiser as a program have real problems with trying to get an enterprise-wide system going. This is not an easy thing to do.
If I could make one other comment, by the terms of Senate Bill 1, if I have an intention to go out and spend more than, I think, $1 million on anything IT-related, you will individually get a letter from me explaining that. And then because of the nature of our budget, since we're now back on the state budget and not able to operate off budget, I'll need to go through the Ways and Means process to be able to get authorization to do that. So your level of control and visibility into that will also be significantly different.
My impression is that as we go forward into the next open enrollment coming up, I guess November again, is that our members will not have to re-enroll in the plans they're in.
That's correct.
That they're in the plan and they will be able to say it. I would urge you, as you think about moving to a different system, remember what a pain in the ass that that represents.
Noted for the record. That if it pleases the chair and the committee, that's actually a good transition to the other topic we came today to be prepared to talk about around insurance rates. That notion of, I'm sorry.
Representative Novus has a question.
No, actually, Senator Monson Anderson.
I just had one brief question. I wanted to switch from IT, though. I wanted to wait till we were done with IT stuff. The sustainability. I remember that we we're always looking at project target enrollments. And I can't remember what the target enrollments were to have a sustainable system. And I remember it being, what, 125,000?
Chair Greenlick, Senator DeMontis-Anderson, I don't recall that number off the top of my head from earlier scenarios. I would say that as a part of developing the fiscal impact statement for Senate Bill 1, we established that we are self-sustaining today and expect to be self-sustaining going forward as we're currently configured and with the services we're currently delivering and at the assessment rate we're currently delivering. That leaves unanswered a question of the cost of a platform after the federal platform stops being free. That's a conversation we'll need to have to come back within the context of Ways and Means, but we are not banking, this is where you're going, we're not banking on a significant jump in enrollment from where we are today to some point in the future that we're not self-sufficient until that point in the future. We know that we need to maintain an assessment that stays under the statutory cap that we have, and that we need to manage our costs to be able to deliver a platform in a way that is consistent with that. So there's not some sort of there's a rainbow and a pot of gold at the end, and once we get to some future number that we're self-sustaining. We are self-sustaining today.
Thank you.
Before we move to the health insurance, I want to talk about SHOP for a minute.
Uh-huh.
We had a lot of testimony going into the development of the exchange from small businesses who were extremely supportive of what we were doing. And they had a vision of the way SHOP ought to work, and I really want to put that on the record as you think about going forward with SHOP. They were very intrigued in this program because it allowed a small business to move from a defined benefit to a defined contribution model. And their vision of the world was, I have 10 employees, I'm willing to put $100 a month in for 10 employees, here's my $1,000 check each month, and let them pick something out of whatever it is and pay whatever difference it is. I think they really had that kind of a vision of a model. I've heard other visions of how SHOP might work, but I think it's going to be very important that as you develop SHOP, you remember how this is exactly what small businesses, who, as I say, were very supportive of the movement, had in their mind. It was not them continuing to have the full burden of picking out what they wanted and paying for it and giving it to their employees. So I just wanted to, I think I've tried to make myself clear on
absolutely
on what is on their mind. Should we move into the...
Can I say one thing? Yeah, just before
sure.
we move
no,
in,
go
I
ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to make a quick comment that you really notice how long we've been here, several of us this session. Started out the session on the committee that voted to close down Cover Oregon and switch it over to you. And so it does make me realize how long the session's been, but it's also a phenomenal amount of work that you have done in that short amount of time. So I just want to thank you for that.
Thank you. Great. With that, if it pleases you, we will move to insurance rates. You talked a minute ago about how easy it will be to just simply renew where you are. One of the messages we'll come back to is that may not be in your best interest based on changes that occur each year in the marketplace, and rates are a piece of that. And so between the two of us, Commissioner Callie and I will do a little bit of a tag team in terms of talking about the rate review process this year.
Great.
All right. Well, so I'll just get, pardon me, for the record, my name is Laura Callie. I'm the insurance commissioner with the Department of Consumer and Business Services. And thank you, Chair Greenlick, members of the committee, and Senate senators who are joining us for having us here to talk about this. Many of you have already received about a week and a half ago a briefing that talked a little bit about the preliminary decisions that we released on June 18th and really provided a background about what we've seen going on in the individual and small group markets in 2014. And so I'll provide a little bit of an overview there just to set some context for where the health insurance industry for those two markets landed in 2014 and how that figured into the filing process and our review process for 2016. Pat mentioned earlier that we have a very competitive market in both our individual and small group markets. We actually have north of a dozen insurance companies in both markets, and that's very unique when you compare us to other insurance markets around the country. There's several states have much more of a dominant player or a handful of dominant players that really capture most of the market share, and that's not necessarily true in Oregon, and there has been some changing in competitive position even in the first 2 years of healthcare reform, and we've also seen that rates tend to drive quite a bit of that. And generally speaking, competition is good for consumers, and we think that it means that consumers have more choices. They also can compare and contrast their different options. But we've observed some things now, having the first year of data under our belt as we embarked on healthcare reform, and it's raised some concerns for us as we look at the nature of the competition that's occurred so far. So if we look at the 2014 financial results, that's the first year that we saw the effect of many of the reforms that were put in place at the federal and state level. And when we set rates for 2014 and 2015, neither the insurance division nor insurance companies had actual data to rely on to assess what the impact of all of those reforms was going to be. And so really all parties who were involved in that had to rely on information that we had prior to the reforms and various sources of analysis about what the impact of bringing in those who were uninsured would be, what the impact of maybe certain people deciding to become self-employed and leave employer markets and buy their own insurance, various other impacts that would change the individual market. And so for the first 2 years of rate development, we were relying very heavily on projections. So now as we got to the 2016 process, it's the first time that we had actual data. The 2014 financial statements were filed with us earlier this year, and what we saw in the individual market in particular was that every single insurance company fell short of covering their costs. So we saw essentially that medical costs combined with the expenses to operate the insurance business exceeded the premiums that were collected. And we saw that to the tune of about $127 million for 2014. And, generally speaking, many insurance companies had other lines of business, were able to be diversified, had capital bases to be able to absorb some of that. But there are a couple of pieces that we had to kind of consider as we look forward to 2016. And I'll just mention a couple and then turn it back over to Pat. But 2015 rates looked a lot like 2014 rates. And from where we're sitting right now, we also have first quarter 2015 financial information, and we're not seeing a significant improvement in the ability of premiums to cover those costs. And so we're potentially looking at 2015 having similar results to 2014.
And so you'd be tempted, I think, in a circumstance like that to say, well, gee, the industry lost $120 million in 14. It looks like they're going to lose something like that again in 15. And if they were all equally large, equally well capitalized, had equally deep pockets, it would be really tempting to say, well, let them go at each other until they run out of money and then let the consumers benefit over that period of time, and then we'll figure out what happens. The problem is the industry is not equally large, equally well capitalized, equally deep pockets. And if you set up a dynamic like that, what you're really doing is setting up a circumstance where the big companies with deep pockets can outlast everybody else, and you end up not with a market with north of a dozen competitors, but a market that potentially looks more like some of the ones we see in other parts of the country, where you have two, three, four competitors, which long term is much less competitive and much less useful for consumers in terms of rates, service levels, all those sorts of things. And so we believe our role in this process is to make sure we don't create a dynamic like that where you can get that kind of a pricing structure. And that leads us to what we look at with what were preliminary and what are now final rate approvals.
Right, and picking up off of that as well, not only do insurance companies have a responsibility to file rates that cover their costs, we actually have a charge in statute to ensure that rates are actuarially sound. And that means that the rates are not too high, but they're also not too low. They need to make a provision for the costs. And as you look at it kind of in the short term, I think, certainly from a consumer perspective, seeing rate increases is not desirable. But if we see a market over a period of time where costs are not being covered by rates, that sets up a, the potential for some pretty significantly harmful circumstances. Less competition, as we've talked about, potential for larger rate increases in the future, as suddenly, you know, even if you've got fewer competitors, if costs aren't being covered in the long run, you're going to start seeing rates rise to cover that in the future. And the other piece that we always have to be considerate of as well is that we need insurance companies to have enough money to pay their claims. And it can be really disruptive and potentially financially harmful to people to have to make a change in their insurance mid-year, start meeting a new deductible mid-year. And so we always have an eye toward ensuring that insurance companies have the funds they need to keep their promises. So as we started looking at the 2016 rates, we issued our preliminary decisions about a week and a half ago. And this is a bit of a new change in our process to do a preliminary decision first and then hold our public hearings after that. And I think that it was a very good move and a very successful one, this successful change for this year's process, and also follows along with some changes that we're going to see taking effect in 2016 due to the passage of House Bill 2605. But in particular, those hearings allowed us to talk more explicitly with insurance companies and to hear from the public in a more explicit way about the findings that affected our decision, and not just get up in and discuss generally what was contained in the filing and repeat some of the correspondence that was already in writing and available on our website. So we had the opportunity to discuss areas of disagreement with insurance companies and to hear from consumers and also from Osberg, who is a consumer advocacy organization that we fund to participate in our process. And as a result of those hearings, the public comment, and you know, the information that we learned in clarifying a few things, we did make a couple of adjustments to the preliminary decisions. And there were four adjustments on the individual market side. There was one adjustment on the small group side. And I think that showed the value of having a preliminary decision out there, being able to discuss it more more robustly, and to make sure that we really are considering all the information that, that is contained in the filing and that we're issuing fair decisions. And I think that there is evidence that there was evidence introduced in that discussion that we really did factor in finalizing our decisions. And
I'm so sorry, Mr. Chair. I'm so sorry to interrupt. I have to be at Ways and Means at 2. Could I ask a quick question now? Would that
be okay? Absolutely.
Thank you so much, Mr. Chair.
Anytime.
Ms. Callie, this is really helpful to us. Do you have a sense, one of the things I've been wondering a lot as we've gone into this whole process is whether we would in fact see what I think we are seeing, which is obviously an increase in utilization. People who've been putting off important health care for a long period of time, gets expensive, right? And it gets us to the place where we are now and the reason that we have to have these rate increases now. Is there any way of telling whether we think it's plausible that given how we're doing with containing costs in Oregon, which I think is true in the commercial market, I mean, the rate of inflation, medical inflation in Oregon, even in the commercial market, is lower than it is in the rest of the nation, that we're going to start to see that turn around over time? Or do you all really expect this to continue to go up at about the same rate for an indefinite period of time?
So, Chair Greenlee, Senator Steiner Hayward. If this is an issue that we've wrestled with, and also in looking forward to 2016, how is that going to look different from the first year, the first 2 years of health care reform? So I would agree that we are seeing a relatively low rate of inflation in medical costs, but we still are seeing medical inflation. I mean, it still is growing year over year.
Sure.
Our actuarial staff did their own analysis of what we believe 2016 might look like. And we did recognize some expected improvement in average claims costs. So we considered the factors that you were discussing around people having pent-up demand for healthcare services when they first came into the market, and that would wear off to a degree over a period of time, and that you'd also, as people actually sought services and improved their health, you'd see some impact of that going forward. We also have the transitional plans in the individual market coming back into the full pool. So we're going to see that help that out. So we did expect that those factors combined are going to serve to improve costs a bit. But we have a couple of other factors that are still in the mix. So, you know, we talked a little bit about medical trend, that there is still kind of this year-over-year growth, and that's something that we are looking at and looking to actually use some tools through our All Payer All Claims database in the future to better evaluate that. But there are a couple of, or there's another kind of pretty concrete reason why you'll see some increase year-over-year in the net costs that insurance companies are going to be retaining. One of the federal programs that was intended to help stabilize rates in the individual market is the reinsurance program, and it phases out over a period of 3 years, and so 2016 is the last year that it will exist. And so we saw it had the largest impact in 2014, a smaller impact in 2015, and an even smaller impact in 2016. And then in 2017, it goes away altogether. And so what that is basically getting to is more fully recognizing that insurance companies will be retaining that cost rather than spreading it across the other markets, the small group and the large group. And so we are seeing kind of a rise in the premiums to reflect that reinsurance is having less benefit as well. But I think We're all hopeful that we'll see some stabilization in costs going forward, but it's I'm not sure that I know for sure what's going to happen.
I don't need to ask you to have a crystal ball. That's helpful. Thank you very much. Mr. Chair, thank you for your indulgence.
So if I could make a couple of quick comments to wrap up, and then we'll see if there are other questions that you might have. I think our conclusion, as you can see, is that the market overall was underpriced. And so these rate approvals in a couple of different structural ways really seek to address that and get the range of premium charges much closer to the cost of providing insurance. We're cognizant of the fact that these are rates that people have to pay and that these percentage increases are large. We don't actually, in our analysis, close the gap all the way to making sure that all policies are, we believe, priced at the cost of providing the insurance. We still think even with these increases, the industry will lose a significant amount of money in 2016, albeit quite a bit less than what would have been projected as filed. It's also important to look past the top level number of the percentage increase and look at the result of the rates themselves. If we use the kind of the standard comparison benchmark of a 40-year-old non-smoker in the Portland area with a standard silver plan, half of the policies on offer for that person will be under $300 a month, and that's before the impact of tax credits, which will be available to about 40% of people purchasing insurance. Kaiser Family Foundation just came out with an analysis of about 10 metropolitan areas based on preliminary approvals of rates, and so that's not the final word, but we were definitely, or Portland was one of the markets assessed, and we were definitely in the middle of the channel in terms of those rates, and so these percentage increases are large, but we continue, we believe, to have an affordable.
Can you share that with us, please?
Yes, we certainly can.
Thank you.
And with that,
I'd like to ask a question. I only found three changes from the preliminary to the and the individual market to the final, but there were well over half of the preliminary rates that were put in were changed at the preliminary, at your preliminary rate approval. Could you talk about the processes you use? I mean, I do know a lot. I mean, what made you think that pick anyone, HealthNet at 240 should have been 297? How did you make those kind of analysis? There was some big upward changes. Were there any downward shifts in the
Chair Greenlee? I'm happy to talk a little bit generally about what our process is, and I think we did have a couple of downward adjustments. They were on the higher end, the companies that came in with some higher requests. But the way that we approach rate review is consistent with how we've approached it in the last several years that we've done this. But we have a team of actuaries that dives into these rate filings and looks for a number of pieces. I mentioned before that our primary responsibility is making sure that these rates are actuarially sound, and so that means that they're not too high. We're not allowing insurance companies to overcharge consumers, but they're also not too low, that they're actually making a provision to cover costs. So our actuarial team looks at each individual filing to understand how well the projection will make a provision for future costs. They test various assumptions within the filing. They look at the file, each filing relative to the entire market, and try to identify if we see any outliers. That helps us to evaluate questions we need to ask. We engage in a lot of correspondence with the insurance companies. It's all public, all up on our website, to make sure we fully understand how they've arrived at assumptions, how they've analyzed data, ask for additional information if we need to. And we also compare this with other broader industry resources, things like trend. We'll look to see what's going on in other parts of the country and what some of the benchmarks are to give us a sense of how this is tracking with other information available. And we do engage in the back and forth to make sure that we have an accurate understanding of how the filing is put together and how they've gone from actual costs to a projection of future costs. And so that's led us to a place, or that would typically all take place before our preliminary decision is issued. We had a couple of situations where we still had some outstanding questions, even when we issued a preliminary decision, where we had some areas where we felt we needed further clarification. So the hearings gave us the opportunity to have that discussion, actuary to actuary, to make sure that we had an understanding of how the filing was constructed. And when we received that clarification, we considered that and evaluated whether that changes our assessment of whether the filing is reasonable or not. And I think one of the key things to remember is that, you know, these are projections, so none of us really know what the right answer will be for 2016 yet. We have better information today than we did a year ago, 2 years ago, and so that allows us to, I think, have a better sense of where we think things might go for 2016. But there still is a range around these numbers, and so that's why you do see that there is a range of reasonable projections, and we think that some are on the lower end of a reasonable range and some are on the higher end of the reasonable range.
If I could just make one process comment as well, if you're not involved in this day in and day out, and you wouldn't have a reason to know this, all of this back and forth with the companies is on the record. And so any kind of written documentation back and forth goes on a filing website that is publicly available. This year, conference calls with actuaries were noticed and available to listen into, and the recordings are available. The rate hearings are webcast and then filed so that someone can go and download them and look at them. And so this isn't some sort of we get together in a whatever kind of a filled room actuaries would gather in and make deals. We do this as a discussion on the public record, and I think that's very helpful.
It's very important.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So it is dueling actuaries.
Yeah. Okay. Exciting.
I'm always trying to encourage my kids to become actuaries, but I'm not having any luck with that. All right, I do have a question, though. Is there any difference when you look at insurance where they're also a provider versus an insurance plan that's solely an insurance plan? Like, does that change the way the actuary might look at the rate setting? Or does it not matter at all?
Providence, Kaiser, for example.
Yes. Chair Green, like Representative Nose. So, yes, there are several insurance companies that have a bit of a different model in terms of their linkage to the care delivery system. And I won't speak about any one of them in particular, but I think there are a couple of key principles as we look at the rates. We want to make sure that we understand not just how the model works, but actually how that's going to translate into actual costs at the end of the day, making sure that the rates make a provision for that. So we do look at past data, and we're going to continue to be monitoring all of these companies as we see things emerge. I think what you see here is that there are several companies kind of clustered on the low end of our range. Some of them include more integrated systems where you have a closer alignment between the insurance company and the providers, but it's intermixed with other more traditional insurance companies. So I'm not sure that I can kind of tell you definitively that it's better, cheaper, but I think we have an understanding of how these systems may differ, and we try to make sure that we do have an understanding of how each of these insurers operates and what that translates to in terms of their overhead, their administrative costs, and their projection of future claims. And, we will continue to keep an eye on how that translates into medical claims costs going forward.
Yeah, I guess I'd like to carry this question further. I mean, it seems to me you have two sets of dimensions to balance, and one is to make sure people are charged fair rates on the one hand, and the other is affect the market, the marketplace. I think Pat was talking about the question of why you don't want deep pockets to drive small pockets out of business. But on the other hand, the extent to which competition is supposed to drive efficiencies and reduce costs, you would expect that if a insurance company can honestly figure out, not play games, but can honestly figure out how to be more efficient and therefore to reduce the premium. Let's say Providence, just to pick one out as an example. They can figure out how to use their networks and they can actually drive their costs down. It might be Kaiser, it might be whoever. Wouldn't you want to encourage that effect on the marketplace? I mean, wouldn't you want to reward them for being able to reduce the cost by being more efficient? I noticed you forced Kaiser's rate up pretty far from where they originally proposed. Now, that might be good if you felt they were, I don't know, if you felt they were underpricing, they were trying to monopolize the market or something. But on the other hand, if they were more efficient, don't we want to encourage that?
Yeah, let me jump in and say something unactuarial, and then Commissioner Kelly can correct me.
This is an unactuarial question.
I think what you're articulating would be 100% true if we had a mature, stable market with market participants that had more or less stable populations of customers. But the market we have right now is a market in its infancy where you have a large number of players who are still very aggressively jockeying for market position. Some have candidly, I think, more customers than they may have anticipated. Some have fewer. We've got one player who has none at all because they are a new entrant into the marketplace. And that dynamic of people potentially pricing to figure out where they want to be in the marketplace impacts that in a way that causes the motivation not to be just whoever builds a better mousetrap is able to offer a better price. You've got other factors going into that pricing decision that can get you into this more fraught territory.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. But don't you want to be actually looking for the extent to which this is just a I got a lot of money in the bank, I can drive all the business to me, and then I can screw them later when I have them in my system, as opposed to literally having a better mousetrap.
Go ahead.
Chair Greenlich, so I will also provide a non-actuarial answer since I'm not a health actuary. I'm a different
this
brand.
Isn't really an actuarial
right,
question.
Right, no, but I was I'm going to kind of continue on this logic here, but I think that we're saying the same thing in many ways, is that we don't want to kind of set up a situation where we're just allowing kind of competitive forces to drive low rates versus high rates. And I think that probably all of us would share the view that if we do see an insurer or insurers come through with a better mousetrap and we see that translate into lower costs that are realized and support lower premiums, that is going to be a good thing for consumers. So, I think we want to see that kind of innovation happen, hopefully, so that we can get rates under, more stable and more affordable. I do think at the end of the day, though, when you see that there are several rates that we increased in our final decision, it wasn't because we were trying to, affect competition or you make a statement about whether one carrier versus another has a better model, mm-hmm. but really a recognition that we had concerns that the lower filings were not going to adequately cover costs in 2016. It was purely based on that concern.
Representative Weiner has a question.
Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Looking at this, and Representative Greenlich was kind of hitting on the right path of what I've been thinking about the whole healthcare system as I look at it. You have Kaiser coming in here with a low rate. You're bumping them up. New players coming in. It's almost like we're price fixing a little bit because maybe Kaiser is not offering as much or you have to go to their locations where you might have better service from a different plan if you went outside it, so you pay the extra $100. Zoom Health, I guess, I'm assuming that's probably Zoom Care that's coming in. Mm-hmm. Very efficient, the way they do things, boom.
Maybe.
And they're strategic to market. And then you have the traditional just insurance companies that they don't have their own hospitals or their own system, where somebody might want to go with them because they have more choice to go wherever they want to and can negotiate a price with their doctors or things like that. So I'm wondering why we're forcing these, because you move them all up and they basically you're all within a certain percentage of each other, and you're not giving them one a chance to show. I mean, ZoomCare comes in at 233. Give them a chance to see if they can do it. Why wouldn't we do something like that?
Yeah, so Chair Greenlick, Representative Widener, this is where we do go back to an actuarial answer, which is that despite whatever the logical argument for why a price should be very low, whatever that argument is or how persuasive it may be, they have to have a filing that actuarially demonstrates that it covers the cost of the insurance. And so, again, when Commissioner Kelly talked about raising these rates not to get to some sort of a competitive positioning, but to get them to a place where they were actuarially sound, that's our obligation as regulators, is to make sure that these are actuarially sound sound rates. We're in an environment still where the data is reasonably thin, and as this market continues to mature and we have more data, we'll have a better basis to be able to do those, you know, to be a little bit more speculative. There still is a wide range of rates from, you know, $271 all the way up to nearly $400. And so this market continues to head to, you know, to have vigorous price competition at the low end and outliers at the high end. So I don't think we're trying to narrowly target this into a narrow range. But you are now talking about a large population that, as the population gets larger, starts looking more and more similar. And so the notion that there's a floor around some sort of a tight band because of the cost of health care is not, to me, a terribly surprising outcome, given that a large number of people are going to look a lot similar in terms of their cost of service.
May I follow up, Mr. Chair?
Yes. And then Representative Lively, and then Representative Hayden.
I guess my question is, I mean, because there's a lot of innovative people out there. People are very sharp in finding ways to do things. And I remember it would have been three sessions ago, and actually carried the bill on the floor where we allowed people to actually contract directly with the doctor. And to me, for business and for really lowering cost, it's given a company a chance to go contract with a couple doctors directly in the local community, saying, I'll give you $200 a month or $100 a month for each one of my employees and their family. Doctor has a guaranteed revenue to have his own office there, but then he can carry catastrophic for anything major that happens to go to a hospital at that point. And you're taking a lot of middlemen, people out of the middle, but there's very, very thoughtful business entrepreneurs out there in the medical industry that can do things like that. And I don't know if you're keeping an open mind to that when you're doing these tables or not.
Yeah, no, I think we absolutely are keeping an open mind, and we're trying to figure out how to balance our desire, our strong desire to foster innovation in the marketplace, because that's how we'll be able to drive down healthcare costs collectively, with our obligation to make sure that these companies are able to pay their claims in the future. Because I think you'd agree, the worst outcome is somebody who 4 months in, having now met their deductible, finds their insurance company's gone under because, oops, the entrepreneur was wrong.
Yeah,
and now they got to pay their deductible again.
That's not going to be Kaiser or Providence.
No, probably not. But, you know, we have of these 13 individual providers, they have a range of levels of capitalization, from very well capitalized to reasonably thinly capitalized, closer to the regulatory minimums, and we've got to keep an eye on all of them.
Representative Lively?
Thank you. So this discussion we're having, quote, is ACA-compliant plans. I'm trying to understand the relationship of this discussion and those plans to the larger book of business that many of these companies have, and is there any relationship? You talked about capitalization, but I'm just trying to understand it when you're doing this analysis, and that on these particular plans, that's not all these companies necessarily are doing. So is there any relationship to that?
Sure. Chair Greenlick, Representative Lively. So I think that's important to put this in context. So for the individual market, The ACA compliant plans for 2016 will basically be the entire individual market, with the exception of a small amount of grandfathered plans. So those were the plans that were in existence when the ACA passed federally back in 2010. That group of policies is relatively small.
Okay.
We've used this to differentiate between the transitional plans that we had. The 2015 is the last year that those will be available for individuals. And so really we're talking about the bulk of the individual market. In Oregon, that's about 5% of the population. So it gives you a sense. In the small group market, that market as a whole is another 5% or so of Oregonians, but it's a bit more of a mix. Several more groups are staying on their transitional plans versus moving to an ACA compliant plan. The differences in the benefits for these plans are not as great as the individual market ones were, but there are some certain changes on the in terms of deductibles and out-of-pocket maxes on the ACA compliant plans that don't apply to the transitional plans. But all told, we're talking about 10% of the market.
Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Greenlich. First comment and then a question. History's kind of taught us, going back to 1994 when we started the Oregon Health Plan, we started MCOs, DCOs, mental health organizations. If you look historically at the DCOs, dental care organizations, they started out at 17, and in about 15 years, attrition, private market, insurance, which is lightly connected with you, drove those down to about 4 or 5, depending on how you look at it. So we started again with CCOs. We've got 16, but these are much stronger connection to the insurance companies through the insurance commission, and we're going to probably be realistic to anticipate that those will also consolidate over time. And you've got 12 or 13 insurance providers. As we, from Lane County, as we see Trillium starting to merge with a national and even international larger companies, we can get some good benefit from that, from their deep pockets, as you say, but from the resources available to provide the services here locally. How do you balance that, and what system have you gone through when you look at approving, like, a sale of Trillium, or at least the part of the corporation that is the shareholder, the owners? How do you look at that and balance that with wanting to be proud of and keep your 13, options that we have in Oregon rather than other places in the country that have one or two and you don't have that competition?
Here, let me start, Chair Greenlich, Representative Hayden. Couple of issues wrapped up there. In terms of Trillium, it's a bit of an unusual case in that it is a coordinated care organization fully operated by an insurance company. Most of the other models around the state are some sort of a partnership between an insurance company and the care organization, but they're not one and the same corporate entity. So our regulatory role in this case was unusual. We wouldn't typically get involved in that CCO element, and so really our decision-making around that was governed by how the insurance code looks at the merger of insurance companies, and it really is a question of capitalization and financial controls and management and those kinds of things. If you'll allow me, the CCO-ness of Trillium really is governed more by the contracts it has with the health authority around the management of a CCO, and health authority has spoken directly to those issues. In terms of our existing insurance market, I don't want to convey that we have 13 carriers or 15 in small group, and by God, that's how many we should have forever. I certainly think we have a lot of providers, and if you kind of do the math of what the marketplace looks like, one could make an argument that we probably have more providers, more carriers right now than long-term the market can support. My goal as a regulator is not to end up with a market like Mississippi or Alabama come to mind, where there's one big Blue Cross company and maybe one other, and the dominant carrier has some just huge portion, not just of the 5% individual market, but of all the covered lives. Yeah. And so our goal is to make sure we have a vigorous competitive market and we have an attractive market to entrants, but it's not at all to preserve the exact players that we have or the numbers of players or those sorts of things. I think some change in the marketplace is certainly inevitable.
if I may just tack on a couple of points to that. So in our rate review, we were very conscious that rates should be adequate and that allowing some carriers to be below what we believe to be adequate, if that's the avenue for fostering consolidation, then we aren't actually regulating to create a level playing field. And so that it's really important that any consolidation that may happen is really because companies are able to compete fairly and are also charging rates that we think will cover costs. And so I think that it's important for us to really, from a regulatory perspective, not create or allow dynamics that accelerate that process because there's unfair competition. But I do think that, you know, there's a lot of discussion and a lot of different dynamics in, you know, countrywide around consolidation. We had a carrier who had not been on our not been a large carrier, but actually has withdrawn from the Oregon market just in the last 2 months, and so they did not file individual rates. They were an out-of-state carrier, and there's a lot of discussion at the national level about some of the largest insurance companies proposing to consolidate. And so I think that you know, it's certainly a possibility, but I think from a regulatory perspective, we need to make sure that those decisions are not fostered by allowing for unfair competition.
Being a good competitor because you've figured out how to drive down the cost of delivering your service and that lets you cut your price is different than being able to cut your price because you're able to lose more money than the other guy, right? I mean, that really is that's the key distinction.
Okay. Well, we do appreciate you coming on both topics.
Thank you for inviting
us. Sounds like things are a little more stable exchange side of the world. We hope you can keep it that way.
That's our plan.
Appreciate the way I think this rate review has evolved over the last couple of years. It's very different than it was 2 or 3 years ago. And I think it's very much healthier for that. And we wish you well. We might have to put up with him in the future. We can just talk to you. That would be... We are adjourned.